And after you see something, please welcome Matthew from Santa Paula.
Hey, thank you. My name is Matthew, and I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here, and thank you, Lee and Selena and Debbie and everybody, whoever else, whoever invited Carl to come, because I'm Carl. So thanks for inviting Carl. And Molly and Luis, welcome. I mean, I hope you get what I got. My sobriety date is May 16th, 1993. I've actually been sitting here thinking how frustrating it is doing this. You know, I would love to tell Molly and Luis what's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just don't know that that's possible. But we're stuck with these stories. So I thought today, I just thought, sitting there, like, I'm just going to talk about how these steps transformed my life, you know. I took the first step, I did the first step on May 8th of 1993, and I got sober on May 16th of 1993, and that's possible. And I'm proof. I'm standing here. And it's also just the way it happened to me. And I think this is such, my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, both in my own life and involved in your lives, and the involvement I do in sponsorship and other things I do, is just, I just see grace everywhere. I just see grace. And I don't know, you know, people come here and they have a problem with God. And I had a problem with semantics. I never had a problem with God. You know, what I like to call God is the timeless plenitude of being. And I'll tell you, I was so far away from that when I got sober in May of 1993. But, you know, when I worked the first step, it was May 9th, actually, because May 8th, my brother called me. And he said, hey, tomorrow's Mother's Day. And he said, we think it's probably Mom's last Mother's Day. So my mother was dying of cancer. And I lived a couple miles from her house. And I lived in a beach apartment, and I hadn't seen her in a long time because I was drinking myself to death in this apartment, and nobody knew it. I didn't communicate with anybody. I had a lot of secrets, you know. The vision of this apartment is that I never, it was, the beach was like where the sink is back there, and I could hear the ocean, but I never went out and looked at it. In fact, at night, I wondered what it was. It was really irritating because it never stopped. And I'm wandering around. I used to, you know, remember the night owl things you did? Like I oiled my screen door because I thought it was my screen door. That all night long, you know. And I had a mailbox that was full of mail, you know, because the mail gets angry. The mail got real angry. It turned red. It says final notice. And I'm the kind of guy that doesn't want that energy in my house, so I just left it out in the mailbox. Very much of a downer for me to see people treat me like that in writing. And I had been fired from a job that was beneath me. Just a little bit. Remember that? When you got a job and you thought it was so lame, and then they fire you, and you're like, you can't fire me. This job's so lame, right? But the thing about us is we can't do the lame job either, you know? And I had the best job in the world. I was the lead guitar player for a touring rock and roll band for 11 years. And I drank myself out of that job. And let me tell you, it's really hard to drink yourself out of a rock and roll band. The bar is very low, so low. But I managed to crawl right under that bar, you know. And I joke about it now, but I practiced my whole life for that. I aligned myself with the right people. I have God-given talent. I wrote beautiful songs, you know. And that, I think about that sometimes, you know. When we get up here and we talk about what it was like, you know, we forget to talk about what alcoholism was like. Because what alcoholism is like is it sneaks up on you, right? It doesn't take everything, like in a few days or a few weeks or your first 3 weeks of college, right? It doesn't take your whole life if you party a little bit. Or we'd all come here and surrender. But alcohol sneaks up on you. It takes a little bite, and we adjust down. And it takes a little bite, and you adjust down. And when I was a kid, when I was in high school in Redondo Beach, and when I was in college in Chico State, and you guys are from the part of the state where you know our motto is, I think I went to Chico State. It was quite a party school, right? But if I was your boyfriend, I wrote songs for you. I left love letters under your door. I was fiercely loyal to you. If I took your class, I got an A. If I worked at your shop, I became the manager. That happened to me over and over again. And alcoholism just took a little bite. You know, I started playing this band. It was doing really well. And met some other people, moved to the East Coast, played in this other band. And pretty soon, the distance between the bottle and the trouble has disappeared. But I started off a really decent human being. I told the truth. I grew up with people that loved me. My father taught me character and self-respect. My mother taught me how to treat a woman with dignity and kindness, because my mother was a woman of dignity and kindness. She's why I played music. I wasn't very good at sports. I wasn't not good at sports. I didn't care at all about them, right? Which in this culture is weird. You know what I'm going to be doing Sunday? Not watching football. It's really good for me. But my mother saw this in me. She said, you know, you don't get picked first for the team. And I said, Mom, I couldn't care less about that. She bought me a guitar. And we were broke. We were poor, you know. And she got this guitar. I didn't know we were poor. When you're a kid, you just think everybody lives like you do. But there was a guitar on my bed when I got home that day from school. And I just fell in love with it. And I played all the time because that's who I was. I was dedicated. I was disciplined. And that mother that did that for me was 2 miles away, and it was Mother's Day tomorrow in May 8th of 1993. And I hadn't seen her. And apparently, one of the things I was doing in that apartment was calling my mom and saying, hey, Mom, I'm going to come see you. And I'm sure what happened is I had a moment of clarity. Like, God, Mom's really sick. I don't think they're far away. In fact, you know, for Luis and Molly and everybody who took a chip in their first year, you know, we all describe what alcoholism did to our lives, right? Like, I had warrants out for my arrest. I owed tens of thousands of dollars to people, right? I should have been evicted from that apartment long before I was. Most of my friends were gone because if I was your friend, I was your problem, right? I couldn't get a job. I couldn't tell the truth. I mean, sometimes I told a lie even when the truth would serve me better. I know I'd watch myself do it. I didn't know why I did it. And none of that is why I'm here tonight as a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here because I have alcoholism. I've seen people mess up their lives through sheer stupidity and self-centeredness. Now, you know, you can do it without alcohol and drugs, it turns out. And we're the more common group, for sure. But why I'm here is I would wake up in that apartment, you know, and I had a lot of things I didn't want to face. I had my main job was I was a manager for a restaurant in Hermosa Beach, Marie County. That's the lame job I got after I got kicked out of the last recording studio situation I was in. And I went and got this job, and I didn't like being a manager. I thought it was stupid, but I did realize I had the key to the bar and the phone numbers of all the waitresses, and I clearly went, there's some math that's good here, you know. And the day I got fired from that job, this waitress came up to me and said, I'm pregnant. Yeah. And this is so terrible, and now all the women will hate me, but I'm here to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you lined up any of the other waitresses and said, you know, which one do you want to get pregnant, I would say, nah. And the men are like, I totally get it, you know. Because in my mind, and this is where the Al-Anon knives come out, in my mind, she was selfish and self-centered. Now, just to make this much worse for me in the next few seconds, she was 18. I was 31. Whatever, I'm not running for president. I'm speaking in A. But I had this woman who taught me how to be, you know, and I would go, by calling my mom, I guess, when I hadn't had a drink, or maybe I'd been drinking all night. I'd say, I'm going to come see you, Mom. And I remember a couple times doing that, and I remember what she said. She said, that would be lovely. She didn't say, you called yesterday. She didn't have the energy for that. And I was the good kid. My brother ahead of me, I'm the youngest of four in an Irish Catholic family. My brother ahead of me, 7 years older than me. That was a bit of a surprise. He was a terrible drunk. He stole the car. He ruined everything. He stole everybody's money. He lied all the time. He ruined our lives, you know. So I didn't drink till he got out of high school. But, you know, why I'm here, why I can speak at this meeting is I would wake up most mornings the last 5 or 6 months and think, God, Matthew, whatever you do, don't drink today. And there were all sorts of reasons. A lot because I was just hurting myself. Like, I was physically ill. My digestive system was so screwed up. And, you know, it just was awful. I didn't eat very much, so I was really thin. I didn't know until I got sober that I weighed 108 pounds. I weigh 160 pounds right now, and I don't have a lot of room to lose. And I just don't know where that went. If I would eat those little donuts next door at the coffee, there's a liquor store next door, and they have those white powdered donuts in the little packages, because I thought that was like bulk. And then I get yogurt, because I heard yogurt's like really good for you. I found out later I just got sugar and sugar, you know. But that's all I would eat. I drink gin, and I didn't like gin. Gin got me there faster. I used to drink a lot of beer and recording and touring, and then we started drinking Jack Daniels because we all thought we were Mick Jagger, and then, you know, I'm just drinking gin because it's like fuel, you know. But I would wake up and say, don't drink. And I really didn't want to drink. I didn't want to, you know. And I'd say, God, go get a job. Go do your laundry. Go talk to that pregnant girl's parents and tell them you're a stand-up guy. Go see your mom. Like, all these things would go through my head. And I really didn't want to drink. And for some reason, day after day, I'd think, I'm not going to drink today. But then something happens to me, and they talk about cunning, baffling, and powerful, you know. It's not like alcoholism to me was not like a superhero movie's villain. It wasn't that obvious. Right? I'd get in the shower and think, I'm going to go see mom. And I hadn't taken a shower for a few days maybe, right? And remember when you take a shower and you haven't taken a shower for a few days, you feel this much better? Well, I'm that much better now. And I'm going to go see mom. So I'm a good person and I'm clean. That's 100% better than I was a half an hour ago. And now I'm really, okay, it's 9:30, I haven't had a drink, I'm going to go see mom. I'll do my laundry. And I get out of the shower and I'm getting dried off. I think, well, what does mom know? And then one of the symptoms of the bondage of self happens. I get into fear. When you know you're in the bondage of self, there's lots of ways to know. But fear and blame are really like big symptoms. If I'm blaming people for things and I'm afraid, I'm in what we call an AA, the bondage of self. I didn't know that. I just knew I was afraid now to go see my mom because I don't know what lies I told her. I don't know if she knows about this pregnant girl. I don't know if she knows I got fired. I don't know what they know. I don't know when I talked to them last. I can't remember anything. So now I'm afraid, but I'm still clean. I'm still going to go see mom. And then I think, well, I'll just get a couple beers next door because I never got drunk on a couple beers. And I never have. And I get the change together. I pawn my guitars, which is so humiliating. I have such a beautiful collection of beautiful instruments. And so sometimes I'd have a little money. And when I get really loaded, I'd hide it from myself around the house. Matthew, party of one, you know. And then I'd find it later on. So I'd go next door. Maybe, you know, I'm not drinking two beers. I got to get Foster's or something substantial, right? Because I only have two of them. And then I'm looking behind the guy, Mr. B's Liquor, Bennett, Mr. B's Liquor. And he once said to me, Matthew, you got a problem. And the thing about your problem is it tells you that you don't have a problem. And I'm like, what are you, the Riddler? You know, like, I just want to buy this and go home, you know. And I'd be shuffling back home going, I got so many, what you talking about? I got a ton of problems, you know. And, but he didn't mind selling me my problem. But I'm looking behind him, and then gin, you know, gin's not that much more than two Fosters. In fact, sometimes if you get the worst kind of gin, it's exactly the same price. So I just go, well, I'll buy the gin. I won't drink much. I'll just have a drink. So I can, what my feeling was, if I have a little bit to drink, I can BS my way through the first 10 minutes with my parents so I can figure out what they know and what they don't know. Remember that? We lied all the time. Remember that feeling like, I just have to go in there and wait and see and chuck and jive. And I take the gin home and I never went. I didn't go one time. And my brother called me in May 8th, 1993. He said, I know you're having car trouble. Basically, they didn't know why I disappeared. I like to joke about that because in my family, we're Irish Catholic, right? And any other Irish Catholics, by any weird chance, yeah, I thought maybe there might be a couple people. And in my family, my sister used to say, you know, if there's an elephant in the living room, we just make a coffee table. I feel like we don't look directly at anything, ever. And a car trouble in my family is, what my car trouble is, I had a key to a car. There was a huge mechanism that went on the end of it, and I hadn't seen it in a really long time. But my brother didn't want to hurt my feelings. And he goes, I hear you're having car trouble. And he goes, well, I just want to make sure you're going to come. So I'm already mad, right? Why wouldn't I go see mom? Well, I didn't know I was calling all the time and not showing up. I didn't know because I'd forget. As soon as I did it, I'd forget. So I'm a little mad, and I'm thinking about it. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on. And one of the things that was going on with me is I hated myself so much. And I was full of this bravado. and the way I hated myself was for good reason. You know, well, I grew up in Catholic school, and I remember sitting in the front row in eighth grade, and Sister Dennis Ann looked at me. I think she looked at me. I'm sure every guy in the class thought she looked at them. And she said, you know, if you're even thinking about sex, you're going to hell. And I thought, God, I sometimes forget to think about sex when I'm brushing my teeth. But I'm 14. You know, I have all these I don't know what sex is, but I think about it all the time. And I'm like, I knew I was going to hell for my thoughts. And by the time I get here, I'm going to hell for my actions. I've done so many things that I can't face. And I didn't drink to forget my problems. I drank to get loaded. But what would often happen is I could start new problems without worrying about the old problems. And, you know, my parents were in love with each other. They loved each other. So for 50 years, they loved each other. My dad never said disparaging things. I'd be with my dad at social situations, and people would talk about the old ball and chain. And my father would say, I don't know what's happening in your life, but I met the woman of my dreams. I'm married to the best thing that's ever happened. That's what I grew up in. And when that 18-year-old girl was 8 and a half months pregnant, I pushed her down 5 stairs. And I didn't have any bitch. I wasn't angry at her. I didn't want to hurt her. I didn't want to hurt that baby. I just wanted her to get off the porch. You know, she's standing, I'm up the second floor, and she says, hey, you shouldn't probably drink today. I don't even know what she said. Something along the lines of, we have to go to the doctor, maybe don't party today. And what I heard was she screaming at me that I'm a bum. And I grabbed her wrist, and I just tried to get her pushed back on the porch so I could close the door, but I pushed her too hard. And I knew I pushed her too hard, and I closed the door, and I walked inside as I heard her fall down these concrete steps. And I poured myself some more gin, and I forgot all about it. So that's what I was like. That's what alcoholism manifested in me. That isn't what alcoholism is. I started off a human being, a pretty decent guy. A guy I kind of liked my own company back then. And I ended up an animal. And I got to show up for Mother's Day. I got to show my mom that I love her. I'm going to get flowers. I'm going to take a shower. I'm going to do this right, man. I'm going to go write a card. You know, I have a degree in English and a degree in religious studies. So what I'm really capable of is writing a really good card. nothing to hire me for, but I can write a great card. And I knew I'd do all this stuff for my mom when my brother said it's her last Mother's Day. And I sat down on the couch, and I opened the gin, and he honked his horn. And I went and ruined Mother's Day. And I have no idea what I did. I don't know what I did. I really wish I did, you know. It's hard to do this because it says in the book we won't regret the past, nor wish to close the door on it, because no matter how far down the scale we have fallen, we will see how our experience can help others. And believe me, I'm not. Louise and Molly get this, man. I live a beautiful life. But I relive it when I talk about it. It's painful. I don't regret it. Because it made me who I am today. I like who I am today. But man, it was a terrible path. And I ruined Mother's Day. I don't know what happened. I still don't know what happened. In fact, I asked my sister at my 20-year birthday, and I said, hey, what happened on Mother's Day? My sister's my best friend. And she said, we will never speak of that. I said, well, you know, come on. It's 20 years ago. She said, Alan, you were vile. You were vile to our dear mother. We will never speak of that. And I stand in front of you, they think, why would I do that? Why would I be that way? I've never respected someone as much as I respect Dorothy Mitchell, except Phyllis Mitchell, my wife. And because of Dorothy Mitchell, because of this example of kindness and observation and quiet reflection of my mother, my dad was a boisterous Irishman, funny, boisterous guy. My mom was this quiet, measured person because of her, because that's what I saw. I married the right, lovely person. But I ruined this woman's Mother's Day. She was sick with cancer. She's riddled with cancer. She's dying. My whole family came in and I ruined it. And I'm about to work the first step and I have no idea it's going to happen. And that's what I mean about grace. Grace, it just comes at you. You don't know what's setting the wheels of grace in motion. In fact, Louise, Molly, I'm sorry I keep embarrassing you and saying your name. But there's so much grace that got your feet into this room. And he had no idea, man. There's so many things that happen that one thing hits another thing and knocks the ball off that shelf and it falls in the cup and it rolls across the shelf and it knocks into a basket and pretty soon your life changes, right? And I go home from that. My brother pulls me out of that meeting when I ruined Mother's Day. He goes, let's go home. And we start fighting on the way home. And this is not unusual. You know, we're Irish. We don't even know what it's about. You know, like my brother, you said it perfectly. My oldest brother's a poet. And he said, you know, in our family, in Irish families, because we've all been to Ireland, he said, it's like swans on a lake. Yeah, boy, he's fine, he's fine. And then, wah, 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 wah. Okay, see you at Christmas. All right, see you at Christmas. See ya. Like, nobody cares. Like, us fighting on the way home wasn't new. But it was about to change everything. And I got out of his car, and I slammed the door, and I was so mad at him. And I don't know, this is so funny. This is alcoholism, actually. This is, it says in the book, selfishness and self-centeredness, right? And I'm looking at this guy. He's sober 12 years. He's so sober. He has a house with 12 steps to the front door. He's like that kind of obnoxious sober, right? I don't even know what AA is, right? My brother goes to my parents' house, like what he calls and says, I'm coming over. Then he miraculously shows up. Then he does things like his AA group painted my parents' house. Because my mom was dying and the house needed painted. That's who my brother is. I'm Gollum, living in my beach apartment, sitting on my couch, thinking I have the moral higher ground. That's alcoholism. That's that strangeness, that where you think your life is the only real one, right? You think you'll never be able to conquer these problems. Everyone's out to get me, right? I've heard everyone I know that for some reason I think you're out to get me. And I'm so mad when my brother drives away that I resolve not to lose the argument. Because he's my older brother. I always lose. He's 7 years older. So when I was 11, he was 18. You know, it was a lot of this. And I go in my apartment, I pace around, I get so wound up, and I call him up, and I let him have it. Full blast. I don't know what I said, but years of being his little brother came at him, right? And I'm just screaming. I'm drunk. I'm screaming. I haven't slept for a few days. I just ruined Mother's Day, but I don't want to think about that. I'm letting him have it. And then it's quiet for a second. Because I'm out of steam. And he's quiet. He doesn't respond. He doesn't get mad. He's just quiet. And he finally goes, you know what? I think you have a problem with alcoholism. And this is what happened. I didn't know why I said this. I didn't expect to say this. I said, of course I do. And that's called admitting your powers over alcohol. It's the first part of the first step. I had no idea I did it. And I can tell you, the only thing I remember about that moment is, today I can describe, I'm surprised that I said that. I didn't expect to cop to it. But he said it, and I was angry and worked up and tired, and that hollow, sick feeling you feel when you've been up for a couple of days. And I just admit, I just said it. And I can tell you what the phone felt like in my hand. I can tell you it was beige. It had a cord that went to the floor. I had green shag carpeting. There was a bottle of gin facing the wall that way. There were magazines with pictures cut out of them, which I'm not going to explain at this juncture. Right there. There was Venetian blinds. I could see the dust in the light of the Venetian blinds in the Sunday morning light. And I think the reason I can feel that whole thing and I can experience that is I think I stepped into the present moment for a second. I said, yes, 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 I'm done. I am powerless. And I didn't even know it. And my brother said the funniest thing. He said, don't go anywhere. I'm like, oh, you know, I was going to move to that end of the couch in October, but I won't go anywhere. I hadn't gone anywhere. You know, I went next door to the liquor store and back to my house. And he raced to my house. And I just love him for that. And we're going to finish the mysticism. I know now. I didn't know then why my brother got there so fast. Like, he broke laws. He got there physically too fast for the distance it was from his house to my house. And I know now because he heard the most precious thing. The most precious thing is willingness. And that window of willingness can be so small. And my brother was a really good member of AA. And I thought from past experience, my brother's going to come to the house, beat the crap out of me. That's not a swear word, but okay. And I'll never drink again. right? The one step program of the Mitchell Brothers. Get sober, you're a loser, you know. And I kind of, you know, I really did. He had done some things in the past where I thought maybe he was going to teach me a lesson, right? But that was a long time before. I'm a grown man now. And he's on his way over, and I'm afraid he's going to do that, and part of it kind of wishes he will. I just want somebody to stop the craziness and just punch me in the face. But he didn't. He took me, he walked into my apartment and looked around and it smelled bad. It smelled like a cat box, and I didn't have a cat. You know, I just didn't open the windows because I was afraid the SWAT team would crawl for it or something, you know. And I just so many hard things to explain in that apartment. So we walked down to the beach, and he did this beautiful thing. It's this amazing thing, and I'm just so touched by this. Every time I think about it, he looked at me for a while, and he didn't smoke, but I was like fumbling with these cigarettes, and he took one of my cigarettes and started to smoke with me. And he looked at me for a while, and then he started telling me how he felt when my mom and dad kicked him out of our house when he was 18. And I remember that day because I was 11 years old. I couldn't believe we did it. But he was like living with hell. He stole my guitar, he stole my surfboard. You know, he stole my dad's car. He was always screaming. He disappeared for days. He was so torn up in our house. And we kicked him out. And my brother's sitting there on this lifeguard stand saying, you know, that day, and he just described how he felt. And I just started listening to him a little. And then he said, you know, that day that I got kicked out of my wife and son's house. And I do remember that day. I was 14. And my brother, I thought, was kind of on his way. He had a little family. He had this little job. And my brother, very talented drummer, but he was working in retail. And he called me because he had no one else. Remember, you lose all your friends. He called his 14-year-old brother and said, what am I going to do? My wife and child kicked me out. And I remember that day because I remember what I said. I said, you should stop drinking. And he said, you don't understand. I mean, I didn't because I hadn't had a drink yet. I started drinking when I was 18. From, you know, 14. And then he started talking to me about how I felt when he lived in his car. And that was probably the darkest time for my family. I remember when he lived in his car, I thought, God, one of us is going to die like a dog. One of us. One of the Mitchells, you know. We cared about how we were. We were all educated. We all went to school. We all honored my mother and my father. And we all tried to be caring of each other. I learned all this there. You know, I pawned it all to pay for the party. But I learned it all there. And when my brother lived in his car, I was 17 years old. And I used to, if I had, like I'd tell my dad, hey, I got band practice, and I'd put my Stratocaster and a Fender Twin when I was 17. I'd drive it to the music room, load it in the music room, and then drive my dad's car around until I saw my brother's car, which was a primer gray 52 Cadillac with fins, which he later called the perfect newcomer apartment. But at the time, it sticks out, but it was hard to find. I mean, he parked all over. And I'd look in the window, and if he was in there, if he breathed, if he was in there, he was asleep. He wasn't sitting in his car, you know. And if he wasn't there, I'd leave him there. And he's talking to me about how he felt when he lived in his car, when he got thrown out of his house, when he got thrown out of our house. And right in the middle of it, I realized he's talking to me about how I feel sitting on this lifeguard stand. And I was pretty sure that nobody knew how I felt. And the last guy I would have picked would have been him. And I thought, I look back on that and go, what a loving man. And I later read this book. And it says in the chapter, Working with Others, Tell Them a Little Bit About Your Own Story When They're Confident. Now, I thought my brother would come up and thump me on the chest and yell at me and tell me I ruined Mother's Day and that I was a loser and what had become of me and you used to be somebody and now look at you. I thought he'd do all that stuff. And in fact, I've heard people in AA talk like that. I've heard people in AA say, my sponsor thumped me on the chest and called me stupid. Well, I would like to recommend a book to your sponsor. In this book, it says to actually never do that. It doesn't say, except when you're right. It says, never talk down to an alcoholic. Love and tolerance is our code. You know why? Because Bill failed a lot. And he learned how to do it. I've had a sponsee commit suicide. It was hard. My grandfather, Cornelius Mitchell, my father's father, died in 1945. On my father's deathbed, he said, you know, my dad knew that guy that started your club. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, that guy, Bill Wilson. He came to our house. And all I could think of is, and you're telling me this now. I've been sober 9 years, you know, and my dad died right in front of me. We were very, very close. And apparently Bill Wilson, 12-step Cornelius Mitchell, who died of alcoholism at a young age while my dad was fighting the war. There's a real art to how to do this. And it has nothing to do with thumping people on the chest and calling them stupid or calling them trick or all the other words I've heard around here. And because my brother didn't do that, because my brother showed up and saw a sick man, and he was armed with certain facts about himself, he knew exactly what to do. And the other thing he did is he said, I remember this, he kept saying, what's your plan? And he didn't know half of what was going on, the warrants and the dead and you know, the pregnant. I didn't think they knew about the baby. And I didn't have a plan, so I just admitted I was powerless an hour before, and now my life's unmanageable. I just worked the first step. And I didn't know it. So I want to get into the rest of the steps and how they've affected my life. So my brother said, he kept talking after I ran out of cigarettes, and I started thinking he was being annoying now. Like I didn't like being a little Christian, because I got nothing left to put in me. And now the day's catching up with me, and I'm feeling that weird feeling, and I know I did something bad. And so I threw up my hands and said, you know what, you're right, man, I'm going to go to AA. Because I wanted to be like he was. He's sitting there clear-eyed and honest and showing up for mom and had a job and he could do his wife. And I wanted to be like him. And I said, you know, I'll go to AA. And he laughed. He threw the cigarette off the lifeguard stand and said, you're not going to AA, man. And I go, I'm not? And he said, no, you're going to go to a hospital. And I said, I'm busy. Anybody busy? Remember busy for rehab? Yeah. I go, well, how long? And he's like, 30 days. And I'm like, oh, dude, I can't. He's going to leave all this. Who's not going to pay the rent? And what are we thinking, you know? But I really was terrified. And this is, like, not to be melodramatic, but I had a gun in my mouth 2 days before that. I couldn't be a father. I'm a terrible person. I'm a terrible son. I put a gun in my mouth. I'm very conscientious, though, Catholic school. I took the screen off. I rolled up the curtains. I'm just going to blow my head into the backyard so no one will have to clean up after me. But 2 days later, a guy goes, maybe you go to a hospital. I'm like, that's a little extreme. I was just saying, you know, things aren't that bad. Like, how much worse are they going to get, you know? But that's us, right? And so we walked up to my porch, and he turned to me, and he said, don't die. And I remember that just gave me a shudder because I was embarrassed that I wanted to kill myself. And he said, it's going to take a little while to get this together. So I stopped drinking on May 16th. I worked the first step on May 8th. So what happened is May 15th, he called and said, we're going to come get you tomorrow. I'm going to pick you up and take you to mom's and dad's. I knew he didn't want my parents to see my apartment. I'm going to take you to mom's and dad's place. They're going to take you out to this place. They got lined up. It's a 30-day program. And I go, okay. And I didn't like go, oh, I'm going to rehab. I better pack. You know, I better like brush my teeth. I'm like, I better get loaded. I need some alcohol. Because I wasn't excited about rehab, and I wanted to deliver the specimen that they were going to be dealing with, you know. So I stayed up all night drinking. I banged my head falling down. The way I used to drink is drink a while, fall asleep for a while, wake up, think about going to bed. It seemed like such an effort. I'll just stay here and drink some more. That kind of thing. And then what happened was I was standing up, apparently, and I passed out and hit my head in the wall. And the only reason I know that is because I woke up with my neck against the wall and the phone was ringing, and I thought it was my brother, so I answered it. And it was this woman who said, your daughter was born today. And I had honestly forgotten about them because I am so selfish and so self-centered that Matthew's going to rehab is the news of the day. And they said, can you come to the hospital? I said, yes, not thinking. I had Aurora scrubs on and a t-shirt with a hole in it. I grabbed some flip-flops. I had passed out on a Big Gulp, which still baffles me. I live nowhere near 7-Eleven. I remember when the Martians left stuff at your apartment? The Martians brought a Big Gulp, and I fell on it. I mean, I have no idea where that came from, but it was stuck to me for the whole day, the whole morning. And I woke up, and I grabbed my car key. That's optimism. And I ran out into the light. And I ran around. I did concentric circles. It took me 3 blocks, and I found the old lame AMC I had, and it started, and that's grace, man. It's really grace, you know, and one of the things about grace is it's always here, but you have to surrender, and the more you surrender, the more there is. And my only surrender was, hey, man, I'll go to rehab. I was the tiniest of surrenders. And I drove to the wrong hospital. I think this is so funny. I drove to the hospital where I was born because I'm selfish and self-centered, and that's where babies come from. That one building, all of humanity, because that's where I came from. And they had told me many times where the baby was. But I'm like, yeah, I know where babies come from. I'll be there. And I hauled. I ran out of that hospital so embarrassed, and I ran into the car, and I put my head in the car, and I just started sobbing. And I thought, dude, you're such a loser. You can't even do this. And I decided to shoot myself. I decided to go home and shoot myself. And I used to say, did we rewrite our history, right? And I used to say, I was going to be such a terrible dad, and I'm a terrible son. I had this moment of clarity how bad I was. And that's not actually the truth. The truth is, I was so afraid. What if I actually did need this baby? I don't want that to happen. What if they do get me successfully to be had today? That terrified me. I didn't want to do any of the things that were on the agenda. And I'm a coward, and I take shortcuts. And I decided to shoot myself. And I knew I could. I knew I could now. This is as low as I'm going to get. And I put my head in the steering wheel, and I started the car, and it backfired. It coughed. Like the car bounced. And my head came off the steering wheel, and the name of the hospital came into my head. And that, Luis and Molly, is grace. Because I wasn't trying to think of the name of the hospital. I was trying to build up the courage to pull the trigger. And I do meditate quite a bit now. I do the 11th step. I meditate twice a day, half an hour, 15 years. And you don't think your thoughts, man. They just come and they go. And some of them take you for a little ride. And some of them you get obsessed with. And some of them just go by. And I started the car, and this hospital name came into my head. And I know that that's the time we're planted to be. Because I surrendered a week before on a beach. And I drove to the right hospital. And I ran up the stairs to the room, and I ran down the hall, and I wasn't ready. I didn't think about what's about to happen. I've got lizard brain. I gotta go, you know. And I run into the room, and there's Anna, and she gets up. And you ever seen a woman that's just had a baby? They look awful. Like it's like a truck hit them, you know. And Anna had this curly red hair, and it's all matted to her, and her neck had disappeared. She had no neck. And she got up, and she was like elephant manning across the room. And I don't even like her. And she's coming at me, and she never looked more beautiful. And I didn't know why. I didn't know why. Like, why is she so beautiful? Because she looks terrible. But there's some, like, light coming out of her. And it scared me. And she came towards me. I thought, oh, she's going to hug me. I smell so bad. I haven't had a shower for days. I feel like I'm going to throw up. And she stopped. She didn't hug me. She looked at me, and she was just so glad to see me. And right when she looked up at me, she leaned over this box and pulled out C.P. Rose. And I remembered I'd thrown her down a flight of stairs last time I saw her. And I remembered. And then she handed me Phoebe, and Phoebe was so perfect and so beautiful, and she repulsed me. Because when you're in the bondage of self, everything is filtered through how does it make me look? How does it reflect on me? Now, most men have this moment, and women, I'm sure, but I'm a man. And they have this moment, and suddenly their life's not about them. Suddenly they see, oh, God, my heart broke open. I'm vulnerable now. I have this innocent, vulnerable child in the world. And I saw these two women, and I thought, I can't stand being around you. Because my ugliness is so pronounced next to their beauty and their innocence. I didn't even know how to live in that land. I'm like, I don't even know how to participate where you have launched yourself to. And I was changed. And I lied. I said, I said in front of Phoebe to Anna, I said, everything's going to be all right. And I handed that baby back, and I ran down the stairs, and I knew I was going to pull the trigger. And I raced back to my house, and I ran up my stairs, and my brother standing on my porch, and that is grace. And everybody sitting here has an exact same story. Where something happened, and a ball fell in the basket, and it rolled across the shelf, and it dropped down, and you're surrounded by grace. And my brother's standing there, and I go, I need to go inside. Because I just wanted to swallow that gun, man. I'm afraid. And he goes, no, you don't. And I go, I do. He goes, no, you don't. And I said, I do. And he said, no, I passed your stuff. Get in the car. And I got no gains left. I'm like, well, maybe I need a glass of water, you know. And he said, where you been? I said, my daughter was born. And he walked by me. He didn't say, what's her name? Is she healthy? And I later asked him, I go, I was so cold. And he said, it wasn't cold, man. I was so afraid you were going to die. Because my skeleton was showing. I weigh 108 pounds. I'm breathing fire. I haven't bathed in days. And I'm like, my child was born. He didn't go, oh, that's awesome. And hug me. He went, oh, my God. And he took me to the car, and he drove me to the rehab. And all I know about that rehab is I gained 47 pounds. I don't remember much yet. I was an old-timer in my group, Rotten Rod, for years and years. And he said, you know, he used to stand outside. He'd quit smoking cigarettes. He would chew constantly on toothpicks. You know, those guys. And he goes, you know, a lot of you guys come in here at 90 miles an hour. You're going to skid for a while. And I think that's what happened in the hospital. Like, I don't remember much, but I remember I got out of there thinking, man, I got 30 days. I'm going to go see my baby. I'm going to go see my mom. I got to cure cancer. I got a list of stuff to do. You know? And I'm feeling like, and you know, I joke about it, but remember that? Remember that? Like, a couple of you guys took 30 Louis and Molly, right? I mean, you feel better. Like, for me, like, when it, like, well, I'll explain what happened. My brother took me home. When I got out of his car, 2 hours from my house, I got out of his car and he goes, hey man, go to a meeting tonight. And I'm like, wow, these AA guys, you know, they're so intense, right? And I'm like, I just spent 30 days in the hospital. I haven't seen any, I got stuff to do, a list of things to do, right? But I lie. I just lie reflexively. And I go, yeah, that's something to do. I'm going to go, yeah, of course. Just so he'll drive away. And I walk into my apartment and somebody hands me a beer. Actually, it wasn't a beer, it was a Coors. and this is probably why I'm alive today, you know. And my wife's from Britain and she says American beer is like making love in a canoe. Close to water. Anyway, not on the tape. But. So I get this beer in my hand and I'm looking around. And there's girls in bikinis snorting cocaine off my glass table. There's pot smoke in the air. There's music blasting out of my stereo speakers. None of my other valuables are there, and I don't know any of these people. They broke into my apartment. I probably knew them from other lower companions. I just didn't know them. And there's a beer in my hand, and I looked at everybody, and I turned around, and I put that beer in the porch, and I ran away. And for everybody that just got less than a year chips, congratulations, man. You are in the most tricky time, but also one of the most beautiful times because your life's about to unfold and the foundation's about to grow under you. But what happened to me that day is I didn't have a foundation. I didn't have a connection to a higher power. I got that beer in my hand, and all my favorite Olympic events are going on. You know? And I look into the room, and I think, I got nothing. I mean, I got nothing. I have no possessions. I have no character or self-respect. I have no prospects for making a living because of all the bad things I've done. I can't even get a bank account. But I got 30 days. And I liked it. This thought came into my head. The only thing I could write my name underneath on a piece of paper that would be totally honest, say this belongs exclusively to Matthew, is my 30 days. And I liked it. And it just seems weird, but maybe some of you new guys can remember this. I liked it that when you guys were having a conversation, I was responding to that conversation. But like you're actually laughing when people tell a joke. When somebody's sad, you're sad. Like I was current and aware and alert. I liked that I didn't smell bad. When I was at the rehab, I did really weird things. Like I went to bed at night and I got up in the morning, you know. And they fed me 3 times a day. It was like this weird concept. And I just liked feeling sort of normal. And I ran away. And that is the grace of God. I should have, by all intents and purposes, by years of habit, I would have gone directly up to the young girl kneeling over my glass table and go, can I have some of that? This is my house. But instead, I backed out, threw the cannon down, and ran to a payphone, and I called AA, and I didn't lie to my brother by accident. And I want to tell you about the second step. So I go in, and I go to this payphone, and I call AA, and I tell them, sadly, almost everything I've told you. That poor guy is sent along. I'm like, I'm a rock star and a baby. Sure. Cancer! Oh! Like, I had these like problems, and I felt like he needs to know my problems, right? I need help. I need real help. And I tell this guy all this stuff, and I'm freaking out, and he's going, where are you? And I go, I don't know. And I look out the phone booth. I go, I'm on the corner of Redondo Beach Boulevard and Burl. And he goes, wow. And I said, what? And he goes, that's so weird. And I said, what? And he said, there's a meeting right across the street from where you're standing, and it starts in 15 minutes. Great. Great. It's everywhere. We're swimming in it. And all you got to do is surrender. You got to throw the beer on the porch and run away. And what I said to him, when he said that, I honestly said this. I said, what do you think I should do? So I'm like, I explained that I have fairly unique problems. I'm glad you guys are getting together, but, you know. And the poor guy, he wasn't that advanced. He goes, you should go to the meeting. You should go to the meeting. Like, I know that's what I'm supposed to tell him, right? And I went, and I didn't want to go because I was afraid. I don't know you. And I went, I don't remember. I sat there, and the guy had a suit on, and he got up, and he held the podium, and he said, walk, 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 walk. You know, when you're probably with Molly and Luis are hearing tonight, like, walk, 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 walk. And I remember I was, like, coming out of my skin. You know, I just left a party at my house, and I got nowhere to go. And he pointed to the steps and said, they're tools for living. So I'm starting reading those. I'm like, those are like Chinese. You know? And you know, they're so weird because I have issues, man. But what I was thinking is my circumstances were my issues. Those are not my issues. My issues cause my circumstances, but my issues are clearly addressed in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my biggest issue is I'm blindedly in the bondage of self. And I left that meeting, and I didn't know where to go. And I'm standing out front, and I start to walk into the street, and a guy comes out and goes, aren't you Neil's little brother? Coincidentally, my sober brother is named after my grandfather, who died of alcoholism, Cornelius and Neil. And he said, aren't you Neil's little brother? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I heard you look terrible. And I said, well, that was 30 days ago. I've been working on myself. You know, I was sleeping at night, you know, and eating. And he's like, let me give you a ride home. And I thought that would be great because I ran here. I ran to my first AA meeting, right? And then I walked to his car, and I didn't get in his car. And he said, what's wrong? I said, I can't get in the car. I don't know. I can't go home. I don't have a home. And I explained it to him, and he said, well, can you go to your parents' house? They just live a couple miles from here. Because he painted my parents' house. And I said, no, I can't go there. And I can't go there because I have the perception that my parents are madly in love, right? At that time, they were married for 45 years, and my dad was beside himself with fear that he was going to lose the love of his life, and my mom is sort of frail, and their loser son, fresh out of rehab with a child across town, is not going to show up on their house front doorstep and cause them shame and embarrassment, not to neglect the fact that that would be so humiliating for me. I played at CBGB's in New York City a year ago, and now I'm moving in with my parents in Torrance, California? I don't think so. And that's my perception. And he dropped me off at my parents' house. You guys don't listen to newcomers, you know. And I got out of that car and I walked up there and there's nowhere to go. I'm in suburbia. That'd be like the neighborhoods I grew up to get here. There's other people's parents' house. Right? So I just stood there and one of my guitar picks was on the porch. And I think that's an interesting detail because I hadn't been there for 6 months. And my dad was a fastidious man. And my mother kept a clean home. And yet there was a guitar pick with my signature on it on the ground. And I stared at it because I couldn't figure it out. I stared at it long enough for my mom, who was strapped to an oxygen tank. And back then, they were big old things with wheels. And my dad answered the door because they're from the Midwest. They're from Chicago. They answered the door together. But I must have been there forever, and I didn't want to be there. I wanted to run away, and they opened the door, and they were glad to see me. And I told you about my perception. And the reality was, my mother and father were married for 45 years. They're madly in love with each other. And the boy that they were laying awake at night, praying about, worrying about, fretting about, just walked up on the porch and said the magic words, will you help? I've raised four children to adulthood. Well, they're all over the age of 18. I'm still waiting on one of them. But I love that sentence. I love that question. Dad, will you help me? I had it twice today, two different kids. And I was like, yes, I will. One of them, I gave him advice, and one of them, I told him, no, I'm not going to give you that money. It won't help you. You're going to go make that money. And they said, okay, Dad, I trust you. That's what I got. And I didn't know that it was perfect. I didn't know that your circumstances, no matter how uncomfortable, can be perfect. They're almost always perfect. In fact, being perfect has nothing to do with being comfortable, or none of us would do these damn steps. Doing my fourth step was perfect. It was really uncomfortable. Doing my fifth step was perfect. It was really agonizingly uncomfortable. And my life has got uncomfortable circumstances. Some of you met my wife. My wife is beautiful. My wife is brain damaged and paralyzed. And she's perfect. But things can get a little uncomfortable. And I went into that apartment, or that house, and I went to bed in my old bedroom, which is hard to hold on to your, you know, your pride. There's a poster of Eric Clapton I put up there when I was 14. I said, I'm back, you know. And he was very stoic and quiet my first year. And I got up in the morning and thought, holy God, I'm in my parents' house. And I had a meeting director, and I couldn't, it made me so uncomfortable being in there, you know. I just was coming out of my skin. So I run down the hall, my dad's sitting at breakfast, and I go, hey, Dad, there's a 7 a.m. meeting, can I borrow the car? He goes, if you're going to a meeting, go in the car. I go, okay, I'm just trying to get away from the uncomfortable place. You know, they were doing weird things like being loving and honest. And I honestly hadn't lived like that. Remember that, when honest people made you uncomfortable? I mean, I'm just telling the truth. I was squirming, and probably the safest place on earth for me, I could hardly stand it. And I raced to this AA meeting, and then there were you people. Like my parents times 100. I was so uncomfortable. You're hugging me. I don't know you. You know, you're like, are you new? I'm like, how do you know that? Why are you acting like this? You know, have this coffee. And they're like, oh, God, that's coffee? You know, like, the things that happened to me, the first, like, I would be around you, and then you'd all say sick stuff, and you're like, that's so great. And I'm like, I got to get out of here. And it wasn't like the hospital. So as soon as the hour was up, I'd race back to the other uncomfortable place. Okay? And I'd sit with my parents, and like about noon, my legs tapping on the ground, and my dad's loving my mom, and the TV's on, and the sun's out. I'm like, I got to get out of here. And I race to a noon meeting. And I get to a noon meeting, it's like, wah, 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 wah. I'm like, that's like aliens. And I like race home. Okay? I did that for 6 months. 3 meetings a day. And the second step said, we came to believe. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. All of you new people, it doesn't say, my sponsor read, we agnostics of each other. We said, uncle, uncle, I believe. It's a personal thing that happens to you by being in this. You know, I have newcomers that say, I don't believe in God. And I go, man, if I've been living the way you've been living, I wouldn't believe in God either. You can't see him. But what happened was, one day I woke up, and I smelled the bacon and thought, I'm going to go help Dad make breakfast. He's so nice to Mom. And he doesn't realize. I watched this. I know my mom better than anybody. And my mom was loving him in his self-sufficiency. She was like, he's not going to be with me. I need to teach him things. And she did it so artfully and so covertly and so lovingly. And I'm like, I just want to go out and be with Dad. So I go out and I'm making the bacon and we're talking about it. I go get Mom, I help her down, and I go, oh God, it's almost 7. And the 7 a.m. meeting, Sally comes to that meeting, and she speaks inappropriately about her sex life. I'd really like to be there. You know. Right? We all have a Sally, right? And I race down, race to the meeting, and Sally does not disappoint. Like, oh my God, there was a threesome last night. Like, ah, I don't know, do I thank you notes? Do I write thank you notes? All this, like, and I was came to believe. And what does that mean? I saw you. I wasn't in the body yourself. I saw my loving parents. I saw my loving family in AA. It just fell away. I did the third step on my knees. And my sponsor's living room, he said, we're going to get down on our knees, and I'm going to say a prayer, and I'm going to say part of it, and you're going to say the other part of it. And I go, yeah, no, we're not. Like, I didn't know I had Jeffrey Dahmer as a sponsor. This is like 5 weeks into this guy, and now we're going to hold hands on your living room floor, like this, and pray. And I'm alone, and I'm afraid, and I get down on my knees, and he says, God, I offer myself to thee. And I say, God, I offer myself to thee. And he says, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. And I say, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. And he says, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I thought, oh my God, can that happen? Please. I can't take it anymore. I can't stand it anymore. And to me back then, the bondage of self was the constant dialogue in my head. Not monologue. Pay attention. There's two of us. And they're arguing. You know, well, should we do that? No, that's stupid. I just want to walk across the floor. I wouldn't do it, man. You know. That's what the bondage of self was to me then. The bondage of self to me is so much more now, right? The bondage of self is like, you don't really understand. I just explained my problem to you. You gave me a perfectly good answer, and I said, hey, they don't understand. Or the bondage of self is I'm at some amazing conference, and I'm listening to a speaker, and I'm critiquing them. I'm not free in hearing the message. I'm not getting what you're all getting. I'm getting Matthew's version because I'm in the bondage of self. It just changes. It's more self. You understand it better. And I did that third step on my floor. And one of the things I wanted to make sure I did is talk about the steps then and now. So I'm going to jump on the third step. I'm sober 28 years, right? I've been married for 25 years. My wife had a stroke when we were married for 5 years. She was raised up. We had two little kids. We had Phoebe and two of our own. And they told me she wasn't going to make it probably. And that her brain was swollen. And that things were bad. Somebody used a massager on her neck from sharper energy, tore her carotid artery, and she's paralyzed on her left side. She lost a big handball size of her brain. And an hour before that, we were walking the dog. And she's 38 and beautiful and fit. And now she's in this hospital room, and I'm freaking out for 10 days. I got a hotel room right across the street from UC Irvine Medical Center, one that I could see into her room. Because I was so afraid. If something's going to happen, she's the center of it. She's the center of everything. She's the center of everything. You know, we have an unbelievable love story. We met at a bus stop. We got engaged in 2 weeks. We've been married for 25 years, and we can't get enough of each other. I love and respect my wife. Some of you were lucky enough to meet my wife. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, God, you know, I just started this new job in this new industry, and I'm supposed to go at the end of these 10 days. I'm supposed to go to Chicago for 4 weeks. I need to call him and tell him I can't go. And he goes, why not? And I go, what do you mean? Pip's in ICU. He goes, what, are you a doctor? And I go, well, no, but, you know, she's really hurt, buddy. And he said, look, you just lost half your income. My wife worked for British Airways. And he said, you're the sole breadwinner of what I'm counting now is 5 people. You need to go there, and you need to not tell anyone that your wife just had a stroke because you don't want to be the new guy with problems. And I went, man, she said, it's crazy. And I went up to my wife and I said, babe, you wouldn't believe what Bill just said. And don't worry, I'm not going to do it. But he said, you know, I'm supposed to leave at the end of the week and go to Chicago. And he said, you know, you should go because, you know, I need to support us and they can come visit you and the doctors have this at hand. And Pip was pretty hurt by that, by, you know, by the physically hurt. And she said, well, he's always steered us right. He loves us. He's not saying anything that isn't true. And I went. And that's the third step. I put my small, fearful view and the things I thought I had to do out of fear and let go and stepped up and took someone else's advice who I thought was crazy. And I could give you a dozen examples. So the fourth step, I want to just say this really, Nick, if you're new in your first year, there's a beautiful monk called Anthony Mello, he passed away, but he said some amazing things. And one of the things he said that I'll never forget is he said, loneliness is not dispelled through contact with other people. Loneliness is dispelled through contact with the truth. Think about that. It's not dispelled through contact, conviviality and contact, social interaction. It's dispelled with contact with the truth. And I'll tell you what that means to me. I'm lying to you all the time. I'm trying to keep a facade up of somebody you think is impressive. I've been doing this since I was tiny. I mean, TV commercials are like, this is how you do it. Drink this, wear this, act this way, smell this way. You know, all our lives we get this. And I'm holding up this scaffolding, right, of all this dressing that I'm not. I'm not that person. And it's way away from who I think I am. And that chasm is loneliness. And who I think I am isn't true either. I think I'm a worthless, terrible person. And I'm not. I'm a perfectly capable child of God. And I knew none of this. And I did a fifth step. I did a thorough fourth step. And that just all fell down. I said the truth about myself. I got in contact with the truth. And my loneliness disappeared. And I keep that up I keep those channels open. I talk to my sponsor honestly. I do a lot of things I'm not proud of. I do a lot of things that make me not like me, even after 28 years of sobriety. But I call them up and say, hey, man, I got to tell you about something. Six and seven step when you're new. And I had a lot of problems. I had a lot of character defects. I felt I was like a very lustful person. I hated that about myself. And I struggled with that for years, right? And I'm envious. I think, you know, I was class president, played in a ripping rock and roll band, and dated a head cheerleader. And I thought, God, I wish I knew what everybody else knew. You know, I'm envious. I think you guys all got the secret code. And when you're new, or when I, for years, in six and seven, like, God, please, please help me with this stuff. It's a burden for me. And a lot of the literature on the six and seven step is, you know, you don't want to give this stuff up. I'm done. I want to give it up. And I'll tell you why. This transparency and the freedom and the love of being clean is so much better, you know? And the seven deadly sins, that kind of bugs me. I was raised in a church where there's the seven deadly sins. But you know what they really were? The guy Evagrius Pontius, he was a first century Christian monk. And he meditated because he felt this connection to God. And we've all felt it, right? We've got this, like, I feel it. I'm like, I'm fire and channel. And then it disappears. Like, where'd that go? And then a couple days later, ooh, I'm back, I'm back. God's back, right? And Evagrius Pontius said, I'm going to figure this out. And he meditated for a year. And he wrote down when he felt far from God. And there were seven things that did it. Isn't that so much better than the seven deadly sins? These are, Matthew, there's a parade, there's a party, there's a picnic. You may want to join it. Or you can go off and look at Playboy magazine and eat too much and hide all your money. Or you can come to the picnic. The choice is yours. And that's what six and seven were back then. And what six and seven are now, as I mentioned, my wife, she has some mental disabilities, right? If you met her, she's very present, she's very fluid, but she's bleeding. She's a lot of gas, right? And I have 2 degrees, and I'm a successful businessman now, and I raise these children, and we've had a great partnership. We love each other, but I'm married, like everybody's married. And something will happen, and I'll go, boy, that was rude, what she just did. And I'll go into my desk in my office, and I'll think, God, you know, I did like 6 things for her today. And think about, she just did that? I'm just like, can you believe that? And I start building the file for the case. I'm Johnny Cochran, you know. I'm out there going, oh, I got all this evidence. This is going to be great. I'm not going to lose. And I get the file. I walk down the hall. She's sitting there not knowing anything's wrong. And I blast her. Here's the leak. I throw down the court case, and I lay all my evidence, and I'm a good arguer, and I win. And I watch this beautiful woman. If you met her, she has these unbelievable blue eyes. And they get dark, and she goes behind them. And she feels defeated, or she feels guilty, or she feels battered, but she surrenders, and I win, and I feel terrible, and I want to die, and I want to make it right, and there's no making it right right there. I can say I'm sorry right now, and it doesn't work. And that's 6. I'm willing to not act this way. And I can tell you, 2 years of quarantine, I don't, because I watched this. I will tell you, all the men in the room, where I am, what God has actually done for me, there are a stack of cases on my desk. I still make the case. I just don't go to court. I'm like, oh, that was rude. That was selfish. That was crazy. Oh, well, whatever. Yeah. I don't want to go do that again. And that's 6 and 7, right? 8 and 9 changed my life. I already got $15,000. $15,000. I know to some of you that's a little money. To some of you that's a lot of money. When I was newly sober, it looked like $10 million. Because I didn't have it. And I wasn't going to have it. And I told my sponsor, I don't know what to do. And he says, what do you think? You got to take him a briefcase with $15,000? And I go, well, I owe him $15,000. And he goes, how much could you give him right now? And I said, I got $20. He goes, where is he? And I said, he's in Mexico City. He said, okay, send him $20. So I wrote this letter. He told me to write a letter. And I brought the letter to him, and he crossed off all the self-justification parts. So this beautiful letter became this really short letter, like, I stole your money. And you're so lame. It was like a really good letter. And then it was like this bad. And I wrapped up the $20, and I mailed it to Mexico City. And then a couple weeks later, my sponsor goes, hey, did you send any money to Larry? And I go, yeah. And I sent him $20. He goes, no, no. Did you send him any more money? I go, oh, no. And he goes, well, you should. So then I got a little notebook on my way home, and I sent $20. And then I got a checking account, and I was a big shot, so I sent $40. and I wrote it down. On July 13th, 1996, I paid Larry $30. And a month later, $40. Because when I'm stealing your money, I'm super vague about how much I'm stealing. But when I'm paying you back, I'd be very careful for records of that. I wouldn't want to overpay you, you know. But I paid this guy, I mean, and I felt like walking out to an empty swimming pool with an eyedropper of water and going, someday I will swim, you know, like, I don't, it really felt like so stupid to send him $20. So he called me, and he, years, and he goes, hey, stop sending me this money. And he'd moved back to California, and I said, why? And he said, dude, you've become the son I always thought you could be. You're a good husband. You're a lovely father to Phoebe and your kids, but Larry was my best man. And he said, you paid me back by becoming this man. And I made the mistake of calling my sponsor. And I had the notebook out, and I said, hey, man, I paid him back. And he goes, really? I go, well, I paid him $7,262. He's like, is that how much you owed him? Well, I owed him $15,000. He goes, then you haven't paid him back. And I go, nobody explained that I had. Right? And I told him the whole story. And my sponsor goes, man, you were living in the back room at your parents' house, sending this guy $20 a month. You have a life people would kill to have. You want to stop doing what's working? That's cool. Click. Oh my God, that was an eight. So, Luis and Molly, do not call your sponsor. Very, very expensive. And my father died. My mother died in my arms, and my father died a little. And I was even with her because I'd made it physical and emotional and verbal, every kind of amends I could make. And I had this moment where she rested into my arms and passed away. And a couple of years later, my dad died, right around that phone call. And just before he died, he said, here, I need to give you some money, so you don't have to pay taxes on this money. And it was a lot of money for us. But I said to Pip, I go, hey, babe, this seems weird, but I got to send $8,000 to Larry. And she said, why? And I said, well, I told her the story. And she goes, well, I've never lived like we live. The way you live and the way all your friends come over here, and it just works for us. And if you need to give that money to Larry, hey. So I sent him $8,000, and he called me, and he said, man, you're not going to believe this. And I said, what? And he goes, Wendy and I just found out, I was in his wedding, too. And he said, Wendy and I just found out we were pregnant with our first child, and we're renting this house. And we were wondering if we could buy this house, and we looked at it all night long, and we were almost exactly $8,000 short of a down payment, and the check came today, and that's the grace of God. The loser, the flake, the criminal, got to help this really good man buy a house with his own money. I hate that part of the story. I hate that part. That's like the Jimmy Stewart all goes out of it. Like, but I held on to it. Like, Kelly really needed it. And I'm almost done, and I'll just say that there's 3 minutes left on the clock. And I got to tell you, I could tell you a thousand stories about that. And you know, if you came into my life today, and you know, I know that my success is largely due to the fact that I am even. I paid it back. I do the 12 step. I go to prisons and jails when I don't connect with people in the group environments I live in. I've been to India. I've worked with the dying and with Mother Teresa's house, all because I learned that it is through sacrifice for others that I will find fruit and life and grace and surrender. And sometimes you have to up the surrender to get the grace. And I also found that God never brings two people together to help just one of them. So I want to say something about the 11th step. The short version is, it's not extra credit. People are like, oh yeah, prayer meditation. Even Bill says, we know you don't want to do it. We know it seems stupid. We know it feels like taking a noodle to a knife fight. But try it. And I'll tell you, I was Mr. Activity. I helped at meetings. I had commitments. I did this. I drove people to meetings. I sponsored people. In about 10 years of sobriety, I had no glue in my skeleton. I was walking around faking it. I was acting like I was okay, and I felt empty and dead inside. I felt overwhelmed with stress with my wife and my job. I felt overwhelmed with raising my children. And I went to a meeting and my sponsor said, my grand sponsor said, how much are you meditating? I said, honestly, not at all. She said, okay, double that. And I go, why? She goes, because it changed my life. And then her husband came over, my grand sponsor, and he said, how can I help you? And I go, well, Adele said I should be meditating, but I'm traveling all the time and I'm trying to do all this stuff. And he goes, what time do you get up? And I go, 5. And he goes, okay, I'm going to call you at 6 o'clock every morning. We're going to meditate for 5 minutes. He started doing that 15 years or 18 years ago. 5 minutes became 10 minutes, became 20 minutes, became him and another guy, became a conference call. It's now 45 people every morning. And all, I got a lubrication, man. You know, Clint Hodges said, integrity is having all of your parts above your shoes. And I don't know how to describe what the 11 steps did to me, but it did something very personal. And I guess what I can say is there's a place in me that's still and okay all the time that is bigger than me. And when I'm with Pip and she's depressed about her disability, or my son that suffers from depression and anxiety, I've driven to mental hospitals for him. And I didn't drive there in my shoes, in my self-pity, and the bondage of self. I drove there meditating, thinking, how can I be present for this boy who I would like to be a man? And I'm telling you, these steps, they get bigger, they get wider, they congratulate you, they welcome you, they blow up your world. You know, I'll end with this. I was at a meeting a while ago, and this guy said, you know what AA taught me? He taught me that when you think about it, life sucks. And when you live it, it's amazing. Thank you, love you, sir.
I don't know my name. What's my name?